Now, we imagine there's going to be a fairly contentious cabinet meeting taking place this afternoon on the further easing of COVID-19 restrictions. Any decisions that they may arrive at this afternoon will unlikely to be published until later this month. And today's gathering follows a meeting with representatives of the Entertainment Industry Association and Arts Minister Catherine Martin, who was denied a seat at the table for this morning's subcommittee meeting, despite requesting to attend to make the case for the resumption of large-scale live events. I'm joined now on the line by Elaine O'Connor. She's co-founder of the Event Industry Association of Ireland. Elaine, you're welcome to the programme. It just seems that in many ways, particularly given Catherine Martin's status not being on the COVID-19 subcommittee and not being permitted to attend this meeting, that in many ways the resumption of large-scale live events don't seem to be a priority.
No, it's very disappointing. You know, I suppose we see it as Catherine Martin is our conduit with government, and we have been investing time in the Live Entertainment Working Group and other task forces over the last year to, I suppose, put forward our case. And now at this critical juncture, she's been denied access to essentially the only forum where we can be defended, I suppose, as an industry and helped move forward and towards recovery.
I suppose the matter is further complicated by the fact that the Delta wave is arriving later in the year than had been anticipated. We know that Chief Medical Officer Dr. Tony Holohan on Wednesday told a group of officials and political aides he was concerned by the pandemic scenario at present. Conversely, you have a supporter in the resumption of live events and ceasing any further delay in the easing of COVID-19 restrictions in Maynooth University Professor of Immunology Paul Moynagh, and he's citing the high level of vaccination take-up. 84% of adults now fully vaccinated. Is that something that for you is key to enabling you to return safely to hosting live events?
Absolutely. In lieu of meaningful engagement to date, the Event Industry Association of Ireland actually submitted a event industry recovery plan last week to all facets of government, everybody who was involved, I suppose, in the decision-making process, I suppose, out of an element of desperation to get our point across. But we proposed, we've listened and read through HICRA reports, the NEFID statements, the narrative from government, and responded to that, you know, with a series of phases introducing different safety measures, such as safety certificates, a roadmap, how we can rectify and assist the industry recover. And this is, I suppose, our first opportunity to ever really get that information, that industry knowledge across to them. So we hope that it was timely. We hope that all the relevant parties received that. And we hope, most importantly, that it's given Catherine Martin, I guess, almost the ammunition to defend, I suppose, most critically, the low-level risk event types that we could be putting on right now and that are being prevented by misinterpretation and misunderstanding of guidelines and regulations. You know, it's very, very challenging out there for events that should be able to take place right now. And we need to, I suppose, we have proven ourselves as an industry to be able to deliver safe environments through test events and things like that. And we can't be held back now due to a lack of understanding of our industry by government, you know.
And Elaine, what kinds of events are those low-level, low-risk events?
Well, anything from, say, for example, a business-to-business trade show, a circus. The majority of operators are operating with their walls off, their tents, high roofs, lots of ventilation. And I guess, you know, but community events, parades, low-level concerts, parks activities, you know, we're all, I suppose, been brushed across with the same stroke here, you know. And what we've said to them time and time again for the last year is when you compare our activity to the likes of any other retail business or anything else, it's, you know, it's just not comparable. We've enhanced safety measures across the board. Our current max capacity outdoors is 500 people. That's the equivalent of a busy little store over the course of a Friday, you know, and we have people monitoring crowd movement. We've all the hand sanitizing facilities and things like that. We'd be proposing those and putting them in place, and yet we're still having massive problems with, we call it event hesitancy, you know, a lack of understanding of what we can and can't achieve in those environments. It's almost a discriminatory position to be in, you know.
I think it's really valuable that you've pointed, Elaine, to those kinds of lower level events, those parades, those you know, community gatherings. get-togethers, those kind of business trade shows? Mm. Because I think when most people hear live event, they think 2 o'clock in the morning, small intimate gig, 100 people jammed into a teeny tiny room having the time of their lives. And that's great. And there's a place for that, but perhaps not right now. But you are trying to advocate for a vast range of events.
Oh, absolutely. When you think of the social impact of removing events and that social engagement from society, like we're seeing that really dramatically, particularly in the, say, 17 to 19 year olds, you know, they haven't had an opportunity to experience that aspect of life in a professional environment. What more can I say? You know, we have society now isn't providing a safe environment for people to gather in general, you know, and this is something, it's our forte, and it's a vital piece that's missing. Like, we at the stakeholder forum meeting yesterday, we discussed the lack of having children at events for the last year, and I think it was Maureen Kennelly from the Arts Council mentioned a five-year-old is only five for 1 year. You know, they'll never get that time back, and as a parent of two children, I can tell you I can see the impact every day of not being able to bring them to low-level things, markets, the circus, you know, the small kind of local just things that we've done since the beginning of time, you know, just to try disappointing.
There's two event horizons, Elaine, coming careening towards the event sector. One is the fact that you have no roadmap. We have this crunch meeting this afternoon. Whatever is decided, we won't know about it until the end of the month. And then the other is that next month, the beginning step down of the pandemic unemployment payment, which thousands of your members have been subsisting on for since March of 2020 will begin. It'll be gone by February.
Absolutely. Like, we, you know, there are people surviving on that. We're already struggling. You know, people have come off the PUP to go and do the available work to them through the live performance support schemes, and now we find ourselves facing a very, like, this winter and spring season will be as bleak for us as last year. There's no two ways about it. We called for the government to maintain the support, and we've always maintained that the supports that were delivered at the start of the pandemic are just as valid today for our industry and continue to be. And that's until we get back on our feet. And that's until, you know, I mean that in a meaningful way. You know, when we see St. Patrick's Day happening in its true format, that's when we've recovered, not a token piece of activity outside to kind of satisfy us for this year, you know.
And how do you feel, Elaine, when you look at other countries next door to us in the UK, across Europe and elsewhere, when you see how they have elected to manage the resumption of live events?
Well, I suppose part of my profession would be risk management and safety. So, you know, caution, I suppose, we would always risk assess our activity and things like that. So for me personally, I guess it's challenging on all fronts to quantify. You know, they obviously have their overarching risk assessment and methodology for their country, and that's how they've factored events into that. I suppose we'd like to see at least a happy medium. You know we can deliver the event safely. We know that the stakeholders are on board. We just need to really define the parameters and move forward in a phased and gradual way that everyone can move past with all of the event hesitancy part of it, you know.
Elaine O'Connor, co-founder of Event Industry Association of Ireland, thank you indeed for joining us. As I said, there is a crunch cabinet meeting on this and related matters this afternoon. We're not expecting a firm decision or the publication of a codified roadmap until later this month. But there will, of course, be myriad leaks and kite flying in the interim. Now, spontaneous vehicle fires are becoming more and more rare all the time with the advances in engine construction in particular. But they can happen. To discuss how to deal with it, joined on the line by Lauren Behan. She's a broadcaster and deputy editor at AA Roadwatch. Lauren, you're very welcome to the programme.
Good afternoon, Ciara.
It's never happened to me, but it did happen to a friend of mine, and the story he relayed was absolutely terrifying. Just driving down the road and suddenly there's flames coming out from under the bonnet. It is great that that's a relatively rare occurrence.
Yeah, no, I don't want anyone, if you're listening, driving in your car, to think, oh God, there are going to be flames any minute. It's not that common at all. It is quite rare. We at AA Roadwatch reported on average one or two a week on main roads like motorways, and fire brigades attended around 2,000 in 2019, 2,000 vehicle fires. But some of those were due to arson. In fact, a lot of them tend to be due to arson here in the UK, which is obviously a big problem, but less scary if you're a driver, because that means it's less likely to happen on the road. And not all reports of fires turned out to be fully fledged fires either. Some of them could be false alarms. things like steam from the car's radiator or dust from the airbags, but it is always better to be safe than sorry. So if you see what you think is smoke, always pull in and treat it as a fire until you're sure that it's not.
And I would imagine, Lauren, that those that didn't involve third parties, me being very diplomatic there, the vast majority would be attributable to a mechanical fault or problem.
Those out on the roads, yes. So there's a good study by the US National Fire Prevention Association. Now, it isn't the US, but they found that the most common cause of what they call a highway fire, so that's a non-deliberate fire on the road or at the roadside.
Yeah.
So half of those were caused by mechanical faults and another fifth by electrical faults. So with improvements in manufacturing and tighter regulations on roadworthiness, we should see that getting rarer, and it is. They have dropped by about 80% between 1980 and 2019 in the US. But it also means you should keep on top of your car's maintenance because they're not all faults that are going to appear. It's not like something snaps immediately. That can happen, but often it's, you know, a wire that's frayed over time or something that's been rubbing up for a while and causing friction. So if you get your car maintenance, if you get your services done regularly, you can reduce your risk again. If your car is ever part of a product recall, you should bring it back immediately. And, you know, we tend to think, ah, it'll be grand. I've been driving it and it's been fine and I have that big journey to make next month.
Yeah, so I'll just do that, yeah.
But you are better to bring it back because that means that there is a risk and you're better off to have the minor inconvenience now than the major inconvenience or even serious injury later on.
Electrical issues would also, I would imagine, fall under the same regular maintenance bracket. I'm interested, though, in other causes, because whilst they're as rare as hen's teeth, they are quite interesting. I'm thinking in particular of the recent heat waves that we have. If you had something like an aerosol can, a can of deodorant sitting in the back of the car, that could very easily go up.
Yeah, definitely. Now, they are, as you say, very, very rare. And fires inside the car are even more rare because, due to regulations, the seats and the seat coverings have to be flame retardant. So nowadays, you know, things like cigarettes shouldn't cause a fully fledged fire. You know, it might burn a hole after a while, but if you were to drop a cigarette on your car seat, it shouldn't go up in flames immediately. But you could have things. There was a case in the US where a bottle of water in sunlight refracted the sunlight onto the seat and burnt a hole into the upholstery. If you had a mirror sitting on the seat, or like you said, an aerosol can, that's the sort of thing you should avoid. The same way you should avoid having it on the window ledge in your home, very sunny weather too.
Well, Lauren Behan, broadcaster and deputy editor of AA Roadwatch, thank you indeed for joining us. Very sage advice. Coming up after the break, a Russian spy ship spotted off the West Coast, and which works better to get us to use energy in a more environmental friendly matter, social influence or economic intervention? Interested to know what you think about this. Leaving cert students for the class of 2022 will be given more choice in many written papers in new guidelines published today by the Department of Education. They will be similar to measures introduced just weeks before the 2021 exams, which were the result of a long-running campaign by students. It'll be the third year in a row that adjustments will be made to exams, primarily because of COVID. But it has started the conversation that if this model of more choice works and has worked over the last 2 years, that it should continue. Get in touch 0833 97 97 97. Monitoring of a Russian spy ship off the coast of Ireland is continuing. To discuss this, I'm joined on the line now by security and defence analyst Declan Power. Declan, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you very much.
Tell us what you know about the Yantar.
Well, it is it's a flagged Russian naval vessel, which is a new development in that previous intentions and incursions of this type whereby merchant vessels are flagged as merchant vessels but behaving suspiciously. And this vessel is of a type that is considered to be involved in coastal surveillance activities, electronic surveillance activities, as opposed to more, shall we say, mainstream belligerent military operations. So the question is begged, what exactly is it up to? What is it here for? And that's what the Defence Forces are attempting to find out.
Because, I mean, it happens regularly, if not frequently, Declan, that we hear tell, if you will, of Russian fighter jets in Irish airspace, frequently monitored by the RAF. Would you view this as an escalation of their presence in Irish airspace and maritime waters?
No, not an escalation, but a continuation. It's a variation on a theme, and not to sound pedantic, but the air incursions are usually not by fighter jets. They wouldn't have the range to do something like that. They're usually long-range reconnaissance aircraft that would be, again, filled with a lot of electronic components, or sometimes bombers, aircraft that would be used for long-range bombing missions. And what they're doing is they're teasing and probing the edges of Western Europe's defensive perimeters. In this case, it seems to be slightly different in that the attention would appear to be focused on the underground cables that exist between here and across the Atlantic to the US, carrying a lot of commercially related information and, by the internet between the US and Europe. But I would say, again, it's a variation on the theme of probing sensitive areas, seeing what the response will be, the nature of this response, in order to understand, A, how quickly they will have attention paid to them, B, the nature of how they will be responded to, and C, the joined-up nature of the response. And what I mean by that, and it's probably the most important point, is a country acting in splendid isolation? Like a country like ours, if the only response to them was from our defence forces, they would consider this to be a very successful weak link to exploit, because we simply do not have the electronic means by which to surveil them, much less the military means by which to counter them if they decided to do something.
Because there's little or nothing covert about this. It's the equivalent of a toddler putting their two hands up in front of their face saying, "You can't see me." They evidently want to be seen in either whatever type of aircraft it is, and this particular Yantar, they want to be seen in the vicinity of Ireland and, as you say, test the response.
That's it. And to see what may come of that, there's another aspect. When they talk about testing the response, part of that is the military response, you know, the security response, the governmental response, but also the general attitude of the body politic and the citizenry. So in more recent times, the Russian state pays a lot of attention to social media chatter in particular countries, and oftentimes tries to influence it or to inject a degree of divisiveness into debates and things of that nature, and see can they divest different parts of, say, within the European Union, create dissent. And this is exactly what would have happened now in discussions and debates in the lead up to the sending home of Russian diplomats after the Skripal affair. You know, people may remember the former Russian intelligence agent who was almost murdered himself and his daughter by poisoning. And yeah, it's what it is an exercise in soft power and a soft power incursion, because they know that this isn't going to start a war, and nor is that its intention. But they know that they can exploit the differences. At best, they will have information that will be of military benefit in terms of weaknesses in the Western seaboard, in the edge of Western Europe. And then in a longer ongoing basis, if there is a weakness in attitude to confronting these things. Like, for example, Ireland and the Irish public, you know, so Russian incursions would not be top of our list of threats and concerns.
No.
In a way that would be totally different if you were Finnish, or if you were Estonian, or a country of that nature that's much more, that actually has a land border with Russia and who has experienced Russian aggression in the past. So they're looking to see, okay, these are things that we can make use of at a different point, at a different stage.
And
they're constantly gathering intelligence as to the nature of soft underbellies around Western Europe.
And Declan, in your view, what weaknesses are they likely to have encountered attitudinally, militarily, and otherwise?
Well, militarily, they will, you know, from an infrastructural point of view, they're looking at these cables and seeing, well, what is the reaction time? What type of reaction is there? And then, as I said earlier, the joined up reaction. So if it's just off the coast of Ireland, the Irish territorial waters, the Defence Force, our naval service would probably be the first to respond. But you can be sure that there will be electronic surveillance attention being paid by our European Union partners and our near neighbour, the United Kingdom. And they'll be trying to ascertain how much of an interconnectedness there would be, how much of a partnership approach there would be. Could they exploit differences? If we were trying to exist in splendid isolation, and thankfully we're not, we've got a number of partnership arrangements in place. But they would exploit the isolated nature of our response, which might have been the case 30, 40 years ago. Then there would also be the political aspect. What type of response would there be in Parliament? Would there be attempts to point the finger at them? Would there be people who would come out of the woodwork to defend them and claim that they should be left alone? Mm-hmm. And they're probing for, I suppose you could argue, moral weakness as well as military weakness.
Testing the fence, as it were. Declan Power, security and defence analyst, thank you indeed for joining us. Now we are going to continue our coverage of Heritage Week and listen about John de Roebuck.
National Heritage Week, in association with Kildare County Council, kildare.ie or at Kildare Heritage.
Famous Kildare people on KFM.
John de Roebuck, British Army Admiral. John de Roebuck was born in Naas in 1862 and entered the British Navy in 1875, reaching the rank of Rear Admiral in 1911. In 1914, he took command of the East Mediterranean Squadron and was tasked with the Dardanelles expedition, which proved a failure due to the unexpected presence of a Turkish minefield and Turkish troops on high ground around the narrow straits. De Roebuck was praised for his role in assisting the evacuation of Gallipoli towards the end of 1915, and the following year was promoted to Vice Admiral. From 1922 until 1924, he served as commander of the British Atlantic Fleet. He died in 1928.
KFM supporting Kildare's wealth of local history and heritage.
And that is, of course, part of our continuing coverage of Heritage Week and Kildare. Heritage Officer Bridget Loughlin will be Clem Ryan's guest on Friday's edition of Kildare Today, where we will hear more information on what is happening for the remainder of Heritage Week here in County Kildare. Now, which works better, the carrot or the stick? That is the topic under investigation in the latest ESRI research looking at social influence and economic interventions to motivate energy saving. Which works better? I'm joined on the line by a co-author of this report and a postdoctoral research fellow at the ESRI, Constantine Spandagos. Constantine, you're very welcome to the programme.
Hello, Ciara. Thank you for the invitation.
Delighted to have you. So what you were doing was looking at whether, I suppose, our concepts of shame, connectedness, how easily influenced or not we may be, work better than economic interventions, which could be taxes, which could be grants, which could be any number of things, in order to get us to use less energy.
Yes, in the paper we asked people what kind of interventions are more likely to encourage them to save energy at home by buying more energy-efficient appliances or adjusting their thermostat settings for space heating and cooling. And people identified social influence or peer pressure to be in the first place, to be the most influential, even more than financial measures.
I would imagine if your study was broken down by age cohort that that would be particularly the case for households who might have children in primary school.
Interestingly, no. The effects that we found were not really dependent on socio-demographics, even income. So we found that peer pressure can be equally influential across all ages and across all income levels.
And how did that come to be expressed? Because I don't know, and I'm just one person, that I've ever had a conversation with my peers about energy use and reducing energy consumption, but I could be the outlier.
It's true, we don't really have conversations like that, but there are ways for us to know how our energy consumption compares to the one of our peers. It could be in our utility bills. We can have this indication, either paper or digital utility bills.
And how positive an impact on household behaviour did that kind of peer pressure have? Was it a sea change, or were there incremental change over time in energy usage?
Well, in our study, you know, it was more hypothetical questions. We were trying some scenarios, and we were asking people, you know, if your neighbors were doing this, this, and that to save energy and protect the environment, would you be willing to do the same? And they were giving us the answers. So we didn't have an actual intervention, but our hypotheses were based on real experiments that took place, for instance, in the U.S., in the Netherlands. And people there have seen that, you know, this intervention that I mentioned, sharing the information about energy consumption of the neighborhood or of the street or of the building, helped them to reduce energy by even 5 or 10%. And that's not small. Even that 5 or 10% can have a big impact in reducing CO2 emissions and protecting the environment.
And were you surprised, Constantine, that an economic intervention was less influential?
It was less influential than a social influence in peer comparison, but they were also important. Of course, we were talking about penalties, right? In case you overconsume, or rewards in case you consume less than a threshold. They were popular too, but not as much as social influence. And you know, there are some concerns about these measures. The literature has shown that maybe their effects are not persistent in time. So we place a financial intervention, the behavior changes in the beginning, but later, if we remove it, there's a high chance that we will go back to the previous behavior. On the other hand, social influence can create more sustainable results in time.
And was that an expected finding, Constantine?
I would say in general, yes. We have seen this happening in other parts of the world. We actually conducted this study in Hong Kong, and maybe it was not expected to happen there because, you know, Hong Kong is a very densely populated place. It's a very busy place, and people, you know, mind their business. We actually asked them to identify with how many peers they normally, you know, talk to during a typical month. And most people say that they don't talk to more than 20 people per month. That's less than one per day, right?
Yeah.
But still, in spite of that, we found that social influence, you know, really matters to them. So I suspect that, you know, the evolution of social media technology perhaps changes the concepts of localization. So now it's different to say, you know, who is our peer, who is our local. We might not be talking directly to our neighbor, but maybe there is a person in America, Australia, Africa that we follow on the social media, and this person can influence us.
And also that changed concept of who may be a connection, a social influence in your life, also will change dependent upon the quality of that interaction. So you mentioned the people in Hong Kong may have only been speaking to effectively one person a day. But in social media terms, then the tone and weight of the statements by a person from whom you draw influence can have a greater impact.
We found that it could be pretty much the same impact. So, of course, you know, physical interaction, we believe, is always better. But social media interaction was not less in importance. And maybe, you know, now with the pandemic, that's quite important. I mean, people don't really go out to socialize. But again, through technology, through social media, they could be influenced for something good. They could be a good way to spread some positive message like that.
Well, Constantine Spandagos, a research fellow, postdoctoral research fellow indeed at the ESRI, thank you indeed for joining us. Now, I'm joined on the line by Geraldine O'Flaherty. Geraldine, you're very welcome to the programme.
Hi, Ciara, thank you.
You are the very proud housemate of Bichon Frise, Teddy Bone Bear. Tell us all about Teddy.
That's correct, yeah. Well, he's a Bichon Frise. He's a lovable little guy. He's this year's entry, this year's Kildare entry for the Nose of Tralee competition. He's representing Kildare and he's very proud to be doing it.
Tell us a little about the Nose of Tralee. Obviously it's modelled on the Rose of Tralee, which nobody has seen in 2 years because we haven't had it. But how does the Nose of Tralee work? How will Teddy and his colleague contestants be judged?
Sure, yeah. Well, it's a voting. There's a daily voting. It's like a public voting. And what you do is you click on this link and you can vote. You can vote every day, every 24 hours. And the voting finishes then, the last day is the 24th of August at 6 p.m. where the winner is announced live, the winner and the runner-up.
So there's only a couple of days left because that's Tuesday, isn't it?
I know. Yeah. There's only 5 days, I know.
And how many dogs are in the competition?
Oh, well, there's 32 pets, you see. It's Pet Sitters is the company who actually run it.
So you could have any pet at all. So if I had a pet giraffe, I could enter
it. A giraffe, There was an alpaca. Teddy was against a chicken, so there was three semi-finalists, and he was against another dog and a chicken, and luckily he got it. Any pet, but there's two cats and 30 dogs.
Oh my God, poor old cats are outnumbered. And
I know.
What's the prize apart from the honour, Geraldine, of being the 2021 Nose of Tralee?
Yeah, well, you get the winner sash. He has a sash at the moment for becoming the finalist for Kildare. But you get the winner sash. Tesco are sponsoring it. So you get some Tesco vouchers. You get vouchers from pet sitters themselves, where they will actually, if you need to go away, you know, you can leave your pet with them. And they will, it's like another home in a way, if you like. They're really good with animals.
Remind us where people can vote again, Geraldine, if they want to do so.
Sure, yeah. Well, Teddy has his own Instagram page. It's Teddy Bombear _7_11_16. You can vote on that. You can vote on my Facebook page, and then you can go on to the petsitters.com website, and there's a link to vote there.
Well, the very best of luck to Teddy Bourne Bear, bringing home the title to County Kildare. And Geraldine O'Flaherty, thanks so much for joining us.